What it made us both realise was how close the audience were going to be to us. That to me was that moment. It's all about an inner confidence, not a big-headedness. But it doesn't mean to say that in the world you are confident. It's just you have to portray yourself at times in that way. I had to look after myself. It's not something I wanted to do. I'd rather go on and play the game of football than have a laugh.
Parasite, pervert, a worm, a self-confessed player of the pink oboe.
And welcome to the Richard Rudin podcast. And we've come outside today. Last time we were in Crosby speaking to Charlie Lambert. And this week, this time, it's my great pleasure to introduce one of my new mates. We're mates, aren't we?
Oh, we're definitely mates, la. How are you?
I'm sound. Sound of a fucking pound, mate.
Sound
of a we're just outside St Helens in what was... Whoa, the umbrella's come down.
So there you, this is what happens when you sit outside.
There we go. To your place, very nice with beautiful views at the back here, just to plenty of views that used to belong, all this belonged to Pilkington's, I believe.
Yeah, Pilkington, the Pilkington family, yeah. So, I've now got the privilege of a working class lad now owning a part of the posh estate, yeah. Yeah, very good.
And the reason we're talking is we've both done an amazing thing for both of us, which is we were stand-up comics for one night at only the world's biggest comedy club, 60,000 square feet of it and three performance spaces, the Hot Water Club in Liverpool. And we did that as part of the Come Together Hub, which I've talked about many times on the podcast. And they paid basically for us to have tuition from a professional stand-up comic, Henry Cherney.
Henry.
And we had 5 weeks of that and then developed our act, which is supposed to be 5 minutes. In both our cases, went a little bit more than that. So had you ever done anything like that before?
Well, to be honest with you, back in the 80s, I was wanting to be an actor. And so I thought, how do I get my equity card? And, of course, you try lots of different ways. I was actually just about to go to drama school. And a mate of mine... had this comedy act. So for charity, I thought, so I'll go along and do it with him. We were supposed to rehearse. We never did. So we ended up going on with basically two different sets. His ideas of what comedy was and mine. And of course, as you can imagine, it just hit the floor. You know, it wasn't great at all. So that was it. That was my one venture into comedy. I'd done a little bit of live stage work, as you know, in acting, but no, nothing like what we did the other night. That
no.
You know, that all that material, that writing all that material and coming up with the ideas, standing there in front of all those people. You know, I mean, the thousands of people. You know, millions.
And we went to the club the Saturday beforehand to get a feel for it. I don't know about you, but I got really nervous after I saw that. I thought, oh my God, this is what it's going to be like.
Well, that was it. We went to the studio, didn't we? We thought, well, go and do our homework, see what it's like. You know, I mean, what do they do at this place? And they were very kind because we didn't have tickets and they let us in when after I'd kind of blagged it. But they were very kind. They got us a couple of seats. And yeah, it was very nerve-wracking. But I think what was even more nerve-wracking is that actually on the night, we weren't in that studio. We thought we were going to be in that small studio. And we were in the bigger space. I'm so glad we went because while I was nervous, you know, what it made us... both realised was how close the audience were going to be to us. That to me was that moment.
And on the night, I mean, I was the last to go on, so I had all you guys before me, and we should say there were some comedians from the previous group of Henrys there as well, including 86-year-old Marie.
Marie, yeah.
Who was absolutely stole the show, I have to say. There's nothing like hearing filthy language coming from the mouth of a sweet-looking 86-year-old.
Talking about 69.
With a young lad. But we have to agree, everyone agreed that she stole the show, yeah, so that's
why. Absolutely.
Right. But in all honesty and without false modesty, how do you think it went for you?
I loved it. I'll be honest with you. While I was like, you know, you were the last to go on, I was the second. I kind of went up after the warm-up, didn't I?
Yeah.
And, I loved it. And you know what? It kind of gave me a passion. Again, you know, that it kind of lit a bit of a fire in my belly. And when we came off,
as it were.
As we came off and we threw off our clothes. As we came off and Henry said, he'd like us both to kind of come to the next ones. I just thought, wouldn't be getting invited if they didn't think we were okay. And there's a lot to learn. There's so much to learn.
And there's even talk, ultimately, he's taking a group to the Edinburgh Fringe this year. We could be going to the Edinburgh Fringe next year, matey.
Wouldn't it be
in my 70th year then.
Well, yeah, I'll be 64, so you know what I mean. I think that's it, and I think that's the message. You know, I don't know about you, but I certainly want to put out there is that there's never a time in life. As I say, I tried all this back when I was in my 20s, but unfortunately, you know, I couldn't carry it on because, you know, I was a working class lad. I just couldn't afford to do it. Do you know what I mean? And I had to go and get a proper job and all that business. So now we're at our age to, if you like, have a second bite of the cherry. And I'm not doing it for, you know, money or whatever. It's just a case of, you know what, it'd be a really nice hobby if we can.
Yeah.
If we can do this.
I mean, you're quite a confident person. You appear to be quite a confident person.
Appearance is a different thing.
Well, people say that about me. Yeah. They're always surprised to find out that I haven't got that much. They say, oh, you've been on the radio. But of course, when on the radio, you have, they're all unseen. I mean, part of my act, as you know, was about actually meeting the real listeners and the disappointment that they had when they met me. But I've had, you know, audiences going into them literally, over a million. But I couldn't see any of them.
No.
Mind you, we could only see the front row when we were doing the stand-up comedy.
I had that great big light as well, because of me being taller than you. I had the spotlight right between my eyes, and I was half the time I didn't even know where the microphone was, you know. I think the thing is about confidence, isn't it? It's something, you know, my previous job was a lecturer, you know, and it's something I always try to explain to young people, particularly 16 to 19-year-olds, was, you know, life is about confidence, you know, sitting down, learning about exam methods, learning how to do a presentation. It's all about confidence. It's all about an inner confidence, not a big-headedness. But it doesn't mean to say that in the world you are confident. It's just, you have to portray yourself at times in that way, because that's what the audience is looking for. They're looking for somebody to be confident. Don't want you coming on stage and like just standing there and
mumbling.
You know, that's it. So
you've got to have some chutzpah.
You've got to be able to channel that inner confidence, haven't you? It is hard, but as a human being, as a day-to-day, you know, I'm as frightened as anybody else, you know. I mean, there's just...
And you mentioned class. You see how you say CLASS. It is an indicator of what class you are.
Like, it's class, like where I'm from, like, you know what I mean?
How important do you think that is to your comedy?
Class. Yeah, but again, I do think it's because, you know, as I say, I do this stereotypical scouse thing where, you know, I start like that, like, you know, but then as I go along, kind of like to chuck in a little bit about, like, you know, basically there are educated scousers out there, And I like to think of myself as one of those, you know. And below those kind of myths of, like, you know, all Scousers, where we're, you know, just wear 110s and Srachis, and, you know what I mean, they're all on the rob. It's like nowhere else. It's like anywhere else in the world, you know. You've got your, you know, you have your kind of people are diverse, and you shouldn't just stereotype one area. Yeah. You know, so.
But do you think having, without putting words in your mouth, yeah, but I think having knowing some kind of toughness background and deprivation and a bit of struggle feeds into the comedy a little bit?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, yeah. You know what I mean? And you know, while I would never wish it on anybody, you know what I mean? I kind of grew up in a kind of, yeah, there was a lot of, like, there was domestic violence and so on and so forth when I was younger.
And if, well, you don't mind, I mean, I know you don't like to talk about the past too much, but you were quite a tough character on the streets, weren't you?
Oh, yeah. You know what I mean? I had to look up. I went to 13 different schools as a kid. You know what I mean? I moved around a lot. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I had to look after myself. It's not something I wanted to do. I'd rather go on and play the game of football than have a laugh. Yeah. But
it's a question of survival, I suppose.
Yeah. It is, but, you know, it's again, it's about turning that into humour. As I say, I wouldn't wish it on anybody, but I'm also proud that I went from, if you like, from those kind of dark days into the light. And I found, and one of the things I have to say is, as I grew older, I found, you know, acting, I found comedy, and I just mean just in life, just seeing life as being funny.
It's like music, isn't it? I mean, I think the best music is soul music myself. And that comes from generations of struggle and humiliation and enslavement. You're talking about American black singers.
Yeah.
And it gives it a certain edge. There's a certain emotional quality which,
absolutely,
frankly, people from a comfortable background haven't got.
Yeah, and you know, even if you take it further back and you look at things like country music and even where soul kind of comes from, it all comes from that kind of working class music. You know, you go back centuries and centuries, but also we as, you know, working class people, the slavery, you know, the thing of the going to work, what my dad had to do, what, you know, my granddad had to do, etc. So, you know, I'm working class, I'm proud of it, you know, and I'm proud that, you know, you see that kind of achievements.
Well, let's talk a little, say a couple of clips of your heroes from comedy. Who are we going to hear first of all?
So, I think one of the ones I'd like to chuck out there is a guy called Mike Harding. Now, a lot of people might not know Mike, but he was a Lancashire lad, and he was big in the 70s country folk music, kind of not country music, but folk music. And but also a comedian. I used to see him, you know, on telly on a Saturday, Friday. I think it used to be a Friday night, something like that, or, you know, BBC Two usually. So yeah, I thought he was somebody.
If I can find it, is there any particular routine you'd like to play?
No.
I feel like Desert Island Discs this year.
Yeah. I think whatever you found of his, I think it'd be great, and I think it's that kind of hurrah to Lancashire as well. Because bearing in mind, while we now call Liverpool part of Merseyside, it is actually, and it is on my birth certificate, Lancashire.
Greater Lancashire.
Yeah.
Right. And just what is it about his comedy that you find funny? What makes it funny?
I think, to be honest with you, it's just, you know what, reflection of life. It's just a reflection on life. And as I think as all the comedians who I like, it's they're all, you know, I could have come up with Ken Dodd, for example. You know, he's a classic one. I think it's that thing about, like, you know, just being realistic about life.
About little babies. It's something that struck me very forcibly last year was that I had forgotten all about little babies. Not forgotten that they were there, that they existed. No, that would be stupid, but I'd forgotten what they were like. And it was my sister who just had a little baby, and I was the godfather at the christening. And I went down, and I'd forgotten that little babies are totally dangerous and unpredictable at both ends. So she said, do you want to hold him? I said, yeah, of course I do. So I'm holding this baby, looking down. I said, hey, he looks like you. He looks, he's look. Then this baby, without any warning whatsoever, suddenly went, both sleeves at once. I thought, that's brilliant. A double-barrel baby, amazing. How can anything so beautiful smell so foul? And then I'd forgotten all about the difference between boy babies and girl babies when it comes to dirty nappies, because little girl babies hate having dirty nappies on. If a little girl baby's got a dirty nappy on, it's the John Wayne walk. She's miserable. She's giving it all. Do you want changing? Come on, then. Little boys, on the other hand, love it. Little boy will drag himself up the legs of a chair. Two pieces of giant Lego, he's going like that. And all of a sudden, he stares into the middle distance with the look of a ruined poet on his face. He raises one leg to take a bit of cheek pressure off. He goes... Oh, that's nice and warm, that is. That's great. Then he flops back onto his bum to spread it. He goes, boom. And you're changing him. You say, how has he managed to crap in his armpits? I do not understand it. And it's true. Our kids, little baby boy, just started toddling at the end of this last summer. And he just got himself up toddling in the garden, hot summer's afternoon. We're all sat out. And he's going across the lawn there, and it's that first baby walk. You know, here's me head, my arse is coming, you know. And he tumbled over and bumped his nose and sort of pushed himself back up into a squatting position. And he's squatting now for about 20 minutes. So I said to Ian, I think he's performing, you know, Ian. I think... So Ian said, Christopher? Have you done a dump in your nappy? No. Really? Really, really, really? This kid got up, staggered across the lawn, with squadrons of flies following him. And the dog's going, I'm not getting blamed for this one. I'm going off. Exit stage left. Gone.
Bit of Mike Harding there. And I'm with Brian Kett. We're talking about comedy in the Richard Rudin podcast this time around. And I'm going to play one now, my turn. And I'm going to completely countering everything we've been talking about, how struggle and class, working class is important in comedy, from somebody who I think produced the best stand-up ever. And he's upper middle class, had no struggle at all in his life, was able to be a dilettante, supported a magazine called Private Eye, privately educated, daddy's got lots of money, but to my mind, the funniest Englishman of my lifetime. So it just proves that you can be funny and be not just middle class, just ordinary middle class like me, but, you know, grammar school boy, but upper middle class. Jeremy Thorpe was leader of the Liberal Party, and a conspiracy to murder with him, with others, to murder his former male lover, a guy called Norman Scott. But the trial of the century, it was called, was at the Old Bailey in 1979. I was in the newsroom at Beacon Radio in the West Midlands, and everybody thought Thorpe was going to go down for this because the evidence seemed absolutely overwhelming that he did conspire with others to have his former male model murdered after he was sort of blackmailing him. And he got off, and everybody was absolutely amazed, including in the newsroom, when we had to scrap and literally burn a documentary that was set up. You know, when somebody's been convicted, they always have a documentary ready.
Really?
Well, of course, they don't produce that on the day. That's produced months leading up to it, and they interview all the witnesses and so on. But, Jesus. Of course, if they're found not guilty, you can't run the bloody thing, because it would be contempt of court to suggest that he was, in fact, guilty and the jury got it wrong. But the point was that the judge is supposed to give a balanced summing up, pointing out to the jury the important bits and the bits they can ignore or should ignore, all the rest of it. But they're supposed to be fairly evenly balanced between the prosecution and defence. And this was the most outrageous, biased judge. But the point was that Peter Cook was on stage at Amnesty International, the secret policeman's ball, the next night. I mean, literally did this within a day. And then stood up with the wig on and everything. You have to imagine him in the courtroom, like just a backdrop. And it takes a while for the audience to get what he's doing, what he's referring to. Think of as just being another pompous judge. Yeah. So let's hear a bit. We won't play the whole thing, but it's on YouTube. It's called The Biased Judge's Speech, if you find it on YouTube. If it's about this extremely biased judge's summing up.
We have been forced to listen to the testimony of Mr. Norma St. John Scott. Scoundrel, parasite, pervert, a worm, a self-confessed player of the pink oboe. A man or woman who by his or her own admission choose pillows. Four kicks. You may believe him to be a vile, discredited, and embittered man. A more unreliable witness upon whose testimony to convict. A man you may rightly think should have become Prime Minister of this country or President of the world. You may, on the other hand, choose to believe Mrs. Scott, in which case I can only say that you need psychiatric help. Over the evidence of the so-called hitman, Mr. Olivia Newton-John, I prefer to draw a discreet veil. He is, as we know, a man with a criminal past, but no criminal future. He is a piece of ordure, a piece of excrement, unable to carry out a simple murder plot. Without cocking the whole thing up.
Well, that, I think, takes some beating in terms of just sheer hilarity. And what I love is, I think the best comedy is when it punches up. So although Cook himself is of the upper middle classes, he's punching up against the establishment.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, again, I'm not in, I've got no issue about what class people come from. It is about opening up the world to... understanding that
the hypocrisies.
Well, I was going to say
the standards.
And the bentness of it all, isn't it? I think there was the most classic one I remember was about Mick Jagger, and the judges, even the Rolling Stones. It's that type of stuff.
I'm not getting into that too much, but I mean Mick, he kind of fought this stuff. I mean, he was a middle class. LSE and grammar school boy. But he obviously took on the might of the establishment, particularly over the drugs thing. And there was a famous editorial in the Times, "Who breaks a butterfly on a wheel?"
Yeah.
Famous editorial saying, you know, these guys are basically doing no harm at all.
Yep.
Now, we could devote a whole podcast to the drugs laws. Through the Come Together Hub, we know a lot of current addicts, people who serve, ex-addicts, people who serve time in prison for that. But that gets into whole... There is a guy called Bill Hicks, who is an American, and he does a whole thing about drugs. Which, let's say a little clip, Bill Hicks, because he exposed the hypocrisies of the drugs laws and the futility of pursuing people through the courts and the criminal justice system for their private use of different types of drugs, especially when you've got the biggest drug of all, which is completely legal.
Alcohol.
Which, is, of course, is alcohol. And this is where my personal bit comes in, because you talk in your act about you used to deal in drugs.
Absolutely.
That's sort of come on at the beginning of your act, but you were dealing with legal drugs, prescription drugs. Well, I had a comfortable lifestyle when I was growing up because of my dad's being a master brewer and being a head brewer. So I've made my lifetime is thanks to drugs as well. So we've both had that background. Anyway, let's hear a bit of Hicks in full flow against not only the hypocrisy of the drugs laws, but the hypocrisy of the media as well.
I used to take drugs and I quit, but I'll tell you something. I have nothing against drugs whatsoever. That's kind of weird, huh? You've never heard that one. Used to take drugs, quit, and have nothing against them. Wow, never heard that. Let's hear more. Okay. I'll tell you something else. I know this is not a very popular idea. You don't hear it very often anymore, but it's the truth. I have taken drugs before, and I had a real good time. Sorry. Didn't murder anybody, didn't rob anybody, didn't rape anybody, didn't beat anybody, didn't lose one fucking job, laughed my ass off, and went about my day. Sorry. And then the next commercial is, this bud's for you. Come on, everybody, let's be hypocritical bastards. It's okay to drink your drug. We meant those other drugs. Those untaxed drugs. Those are the ones that are bad for you. Nicotine, alcohol, good drugs. Coincidentally, tax drugs. Ooh, how does this fucking work? Thank God they're taxing alcohol, man. It means we got those good roads we can get fucked up and drive on. Thank God they're taxing this shit, man. We'd be doing donuts in a wheat field right now. Thank God we're on a highway. Woo! This is a good drug. Because I'll tell you something, I'll be honest, man. If I were going to legalize a drug, it sure wouldn't have been alcohol. Sorry, there's better drugs and better drugs for you. That's a fact. You may stop your internal dialogue. But Bill, alcohol's an acceptable form. Shut the fuck up. You're wrong. Okay? Okay. Shit, man. Not only do I think marijuana should be legalized, I think it should be mandatory.
Okay, well, Bill Hicks, you can find on YouTube. Thank God for YouTube. It's just the greatest depository ever. Unlike the iPlayer, don't bloody start me on the iPlayer and how useless that is in trying to find stuff. Anyway, let's hear a bit more comedy. Who are you going to choose?
Another one going back to the 70s and probably early 80s is Jasper Carrot, the good old Brummie. Another one who'd come from folk music, and you know, good clean fun, as I suppose you'd call it, because again, I'd be listening to that guy when I was about 12 years of age, and I just used to like, you know, the way he talked, and I love accents. I love that thing about accents, be they posh accents or be they, you know, Wales or Birmingham, Cockney and wherever. And I've been lucky, having lived in London, you know, which can be quite a big melting pot of coming across people with lots of different accents. So, yeah, I liked him and I liked the way he'd done things. He was fun.
These are motor insurance claim form statements. I feel like Andy Williams. If you don't know what we're on about here, what happens is, I've been collecting these since 1969, seriously. What happens is, if you drive round in your cars and on bikes, you have accidents. And when you have an accident, the insurance company sends you a claim form, which you fill in, name, address, and on the back, big empty space, says at the top, give in your own words a description of how the accident occurred. And this is where you get your chance to write your version down, you know, which is probably totally different from everybody else's. And it always starts off with, I was driving at 28 mile per hour. And I found some more in Australia. That's actually what I'm going to get around to. But what I'll do first, I'll read some English ones to give you some idea of the way it goes. And these are genuinely, and I mean genuinely, I've checked it out, these are genuinely what people have written on their claim forms when they've had an accident and sent into these insurance offices in London. Going to work at 7 a.m. this morning, I drove out of my drive straight into a bus. The bus was 5 minutes early. Coming home, I drove into the wrong house and collided with a tree I haven't got. The accident was caused by me waving to the man I hit last week. I knocked over a man. He admitted it was his fault that he'd been knocked down before. And then I'm in Australia, okay? I'm in Melbourne, and I'm reading a paper called The Melbourne Age. And much to my delight, they do exactly the same things in Australia as we do, only much better. Australian motor insurance claim form statements. The pedestrian had no idea which direction to run, so I ran over him. I told the police I was not injured, but on removing my hat, I found I had a fractured skull. The bloke was all over the road. I had to swerve a number of times before I hit him. I had been driving for 40 years when I fell asleep at the wheel. I saw a slow-moving, sad-faced old gentleman as he bounced off the bonnet of my car.
So Jasper Carrot there, local hero to me because I grew up around Birmingham, and we were so proud of him.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
when he made the big time, and he had a hit record, Funky Moped, as well.
Yeah, the charts. And I do think, you know, that regional accent thing, it's kind of dying out, especially on the BBC. Yeah. You know, we even now, I know we've got, like, you know, This Is Our City kind of, which is a big one, and we had, like, Happy Valley. But I think, you know, we miss out on all this regional thing and accents. To me, it's the beautiful, the connotations, the noises, everything. I just love them, the colour.
So now you've had that routine, and we've got to get our routine down, or a new routine, to 5 minutes. How difficult is that going to be?
Blimey, that's going to be a challenge for me to only talk for 5 minutes. You know what I'm like. If there was an Olympic, we introduce ourselves, don't we? Yeah. If it was Olympic sports, I tell you what. You know, trying to keep me to 5 minutes, I'd lose every time. I think I've come up with some new material, and I don't know about how you where your material comes from, but mine often comes from, like, when I'm walking my dog, and I think of, like, funny little things that have happened to me in my life, or even, you know, maybe not even so funny. Things that happen in my life, and kind of doing that. So I'm playing with an idea at the moment of, you know, This City Is Ours, which is now going to second series. And if anybody doesn't know it, it's about a gangster family set in Liverpool, and I've got this idea of, like, you know, of suddenly going on, like, you know, has anybody seen this, you know, this TV series, The City Is Ours? Well, I was watching it one night, and then suddenly it come to me, like, Jesus, you know, Jesus, if he had lived in Liverpool, he'd have had proper mates. He'd have had proper mates, do you know? And there wouldn't have been any of this Judas. No, that rat, he'd have been sussed.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the thing about that, you know, that TV series, kind of that's what it plays on. And that goes to, like, my kind of morphing in with another kind of hero of mine, which was Billy Connolly and his Last Supper. Because I kind of go, you know, the idea is now of, like, going, you know, Jesus, you know, because Judas wouldn't have been there. Of course, Jesus wouldn't have ever had a Last Supper. No, he'd have just had a fish supper. and then, like, you know, down the pub with his mates for a couple of bevvies. And then down to that nice nightclub called Heaven, you know. and it's that kind of play on things. And they kind of, those ideas come to me while I'm walking, believe it or not.
Yeah.
You know, it just... just playing with, toying with, like, ideas. And then, as I say, I throw some stuff at you and you look at me and you go, what the hell is he on about? Where has this boy been? You know,
we'll see. All right, so let's give a couple of plugs to the gigs we've got coming up for anybody in the Liverpool area or beyond. They'll be sure not any of ourselves would have a good night, I'm sure.
I'm sure after hearing your podcast, we'll be getting people flying in from America and Australia and all kinds, won't we?
Just to deal with Netflix.
Yeah. Who wants to watch bloody Netflix? Come and watch us live. So yeah, we've got two gigs coming up. One on the 26th of September at the Pocket Cafe in Liverpool, and that's at 7 p.m. And then one on the 10th of the 10th, that's October, isn't it? The 10th of the 10th,
yeah.
The 10th of October at the Liverpool Fringe, at the studio,
Do you know where that
beyond.
Is? 'Cause I don't.
No, I'm sure we can Google it. That's on 6 p.m. to 7:20. So, yeah, you know.
And tickets available for the whole of Liverpool Fringe, which is well worth checking out if you just Google
absolutely.
Liverpool Fringe.
Yeah. But especially us.
But tons of stuff going on. It's a really good event in Liverpool, and they're trying to make it rival Edinburgh, which is ambitious.
Well, I disagree with you. I think, you know, the whole thing about Liverpool, if you look back, you know, I'd have gone Arthur Askey, that's another. I know I'm going back in time.
Hello, playmates,
how are you? Hey. But, you know, we have got such a tapestry in the Liverpool region, and I mean, I'm going right now to, like, St Helens and there, and I'm, you know, on the Wirral, sometimes on the Wirral anyway. But, you know, we've got this tapestry of music, of comedy, of acting and whatever. So I think, you know, a fringe here, we need to celebrate. We need to celebrate ourselves a lot more and pat ourselves on the back more.
And good luck to Paul Smith and everybody involved at the Hot Water Club as well.
Oh, absolutely.
That is just an amazing venue now.
Yeah. Oh, do you know what?
Good food as well.
Yeah, good food, good atmosphere. You know what? Good atmosphere. Yeah. It's outside of the town and stuff. But, of course, it's near the great Everton Football Club, who, of course, are the greatest football team in the whole of the world.
Gave the other lot a good plug last time, so you've evened things up on the original
podcast. Listen, there is no other team, you know, there is absolutely no other team but Everton in the world.
Okay. Thanks very much to Brian. This has been the Richard Rudin podcast. Next time, who knows where we'll be and what madness will ensue. But thanks for listening, and don't forget, if you want to recommend the podcast, we're available on Apple and Spotify, or you can ask Alexa to play Richard Rudin podcast, and she'll do it for you.
And thank you, Richard, for inviting me as well, and I hope you go from success to success after having me on.
We're going to be a double act. That should be the next thing.
Well, exactly.